Welcome everyone. I'm Leslie Forbes, Keeper of Oriental Collections in the Bodleian Library, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here for these lunchtime talks for World Book Day 2008. World Book Day is all about a celebration of books and reading. And we've chosen this year to show you in the Divinity School three unique and magnificent examples of the most well-read books in the world: the Torah, the Bible, and the Quran. And we decided to focus on a theme common to all of them: the creation of the world and everything that is in it. And as well as the display of historic manuscripts, we've invited three distinguished members of Oxford University: Rabbi Dr. Norman Solomon, Reverend Professor Alistair McGrath, and Professor Yahya Michaud, to speak. And they're going to give us, very briefly and concisely, in 10 minutes, their view of creation in each of these world faiths: Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So I'd like to invite our first speaker, Rabbi Dr. Norman Solomon, who is a fellow in modern Jewish theology at the Oxford Centre for Hebrew and Jewish Studies at Yarnton, a lecturer in theology at the University of Oxford. He's written many books, including a very short guide to Judaism, and has participated in many interfaith discussions between Jews, Christians, and Muslims. Dr. Solomon. Thank you.
There are several stories about the origins of the world in the Hebrew Scriptures or Old Testament, but none of them are as full and as distinctive as the two with which the book of Genesis opens. The opening words: when God began to create the sky and the earth was formless and empty. Darkness covered the depths, and a wind from God swept over the waters. God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. God saw that the light was good, so he separated it from darkness. God called the light day, and he called the dark night. Evening came, and morning came, one day. 5 more days of creation follow. On the second day, an expanse is put in place to separate the waters above from the waters below, the sky from the earth. Day 3, dry land is formed with vegetation, and the waters become seas. Day 4, sun, moon, and stars are made, determining night, day, and seasons. Day 5, reptiles, birds, sea monsters, fishes, and land animals are brought forth and blessed. Day 6, man and woman are created together in the image of God. They are to be vegetarians, and God blesses them with the power and responsibility to rule over what he has created. At each stage, God pronounces what he has made good. He then surveys the whole and declares it very good. The seventh day is the Sabbath. Quote again: the sky and the earth, with all their array, were complete. By the seventh day, God finished his work. So he rested on the seventh day from all the work he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and declared it holy, because on it he rested from all the work God had created and done. Now, this powerful story, perhaps originally a New Year liturgy, has several remarkable features. The world, created by God, is entirely good. There's no trace here of the notion of spiritual and material realms which are opposed to one another as good and evil. There are no rival powers to God, no demiurges or demons. The world is balanced and orderly, each species of plant and animal perfect, for the niche it occupies and to reproduce according to its kind. Man and woman are created equal, made in the likeness of God. They are to govern his world as he himself might. And finally, all humanity is one family, descended from one pair of parents. Now, this narrative is an ideal, not a description of the actual mess in which the world usually finds itself. So it has to be balanced by a second narrative in the second and third chapters of Genesis. Here, Adam appears alone, and Eve is created from his own flesh and bone, a device that explains perhaps why the marriage bond is even stronger than that which binds parents and children. A snake tries to persuade Eve that God only forbade eating fruit of the tree because if they ate it, they would become godlike. She sees that the fruit is attractive, eats some, gives some to Adam who eats it too. The snake, Eve, and Adam are all called to account and punished. Eve and Adam are banished from the garden. Eve must give birth henceforth in pain and be dominated by Adam, who will toil to cultivate a reluctant soil. Even so, in this story, there is no demonic power, no Satan or devil who actually challenges God. God remains supreme, and the snake, Eve, and Adam are individually held responsible for having chosen freely to disobey. The two stories that I've described became the common heritage of Christianity and later Judaism. I'll have to leave it to Professor McGrath, if he wishes, to explain how and why some Christians began to read the stories in terms of a cosmic fall brought about by the devil and from which Jesus alone can redeem people. That is certainly not in the plain text of Genesis or to be found in Judaism. The rabbis who defined Judaism in the same period that the early church fathers were defining Christianity saw Adam and Eve rather as the prototype of sinners, not the progenitors of sin, and held that when they subsequently repented, they were forgiven. Many of their descendants, of course, also sinned, but of their own free will and on their own responsibility. They too were punished, and if they repented, they were forgiven. At Mount Sinai, God revealed the Torah to Israel to guide them away from sin, and sacrifices made at the temple in Jerusalem helped to effect reconciliation between the penitent sinner and God. Now, the first Genesis narrative establishes God as creator. Jewish tradition notes the use of two different divine names, one standing for justice, the other for mercy. Had God created the world in strict justice, it could not survive. He therefore blended justice with mercy. In the Middle Ages, Jewish philosophers of religion vigorously upheld the notion of creation out of nothing. Contrary to what they believed was the Aristotelian doctrine of the eternity of the universe. But there were some who held that the essential teaching of Genesis was not about God creating something out of nothing at a certain point in time, but rather that all existence depended totally on God, even if co-eternal with him. Echoes of this medieval debate are heard even today among modern Jewish theologians who attempt to reconcile Genesis with the findings of science that the world is considerably older than the 6,000 or so years that a literal reading of the Bible suggests. The medieval Kabbalah, or Jewish mysticism, followed a different path. Partly under the influence of Christianity, it developed the notion of a cosmic flaw in creation, resulting in sin, Redemption was through obedience to Torah, and the process of cosmic redemption would be completed under the guidance of a Messiah who is yet to come. For me, and for many Jews today who cannot accept the literal sense, the Genesis narratives remain as a powerful testimony to the idea that creation is essentially good, but human nature frail. So far as the earth, one tiny part of creation, is concerned, we are its stewards, responsible for understanding and safeguarding its creatures and its resources. Genesis in this way underpins our concern for the environment and encourages us to strive for the restoration of the state of perfection set out in the opening chapter. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Solomon. Our second speaker is the Reverend Professor Alistair McGrath, who is Professor of Theology at the University of Oxford, a scientist turned theologian, and who is working on the concept of natural theology. He's a prolific author, including having written a book on the creation called Creation, Truth and the Christian Imagination, published in 2004. Professor McGrath.
Well, I'd like to say what an excellent idea it is for the Bodleian Library to have this exhibition and also these lectures on this theme of creation. What I want to do, if I may, is to look at one single Christian writer, and I'm going to look at Augustine of Hippo, a great Christian theologian who was based in what is now Algeria during the late years of the Roman Empire. And Augustine, reflecting on the text that we've been thinking about in the Old Testament and also in the New Testament, began to articulate a vision of the origins of the world. What I want to do is to share that vision with you, and as I share it with you, you may be surprised by it, especially those of you who have been interested in some of the recent North American debates between creationists and evolutionists. So this is what Augustine says. Augustine wrote between the years 405 and 412 a 12-book commentary on the book of Genesis called On Genesis According to the Letter. And he does not understand literal to mean simply saying exactly what the text says. He means trying to bring out its deeper meaning, which often goes beyond what the letter itself says. And he begins by saying it is absolutely clear that the book of Genesis is talking about the creation of the world from nothing. That it's not as if something was already there and had to be remolded. The world was brought into existence in an instant. And interestingly, he reflects on what this means for the idea of time. The whole universe, he argues, is created non in tempore, sed cum tempore. In other words, it's not created in time, as if there was a definite moment that one could point to and say, this is when things began. Rather, Augustine is saying that time itself is part of the created order, that it makes no sense to talk about time apart from the actual creation itself. And therefore, time is something that is created, is part of the universe. And therefore, Augustine basically is trying to get us to think of the idea of temporality as being part of the created order. Time is part of the created order. God, for Augustine, stands outside time. But then Augustine goes on and asks, what do the 6 days of creation mean? And he is very clear these cannot be taken literally, but that rather they refer to something much more extended. For Augustine, creation is something that happens all at once. But for Augustine, creation is about God embedding within the world a series of things that he calls the rationes seminales, the seeds of reason or the rational seeds, things that are embedded in the created order, but which will only become actualized over a long period of time. And therefore, Augustine is arguing is that the world came into being not as we now see it, but with the potentiality to become what we now see. And his argument is that the universe will, we would say, evolve. He doesn't use that word. It will change, he says, it will grow, it will develop as these seeds begin to grow and develop into what they are meant to be. So Augustine, interestingly, is giving us the idea not of a static creation. The world is made, and that's the way it was, and that's the way it will be. But rather, the world was created with the capacity to change. And the fundamental elements that develop over time were there right from the beginning. Now, I think you can see very clearly that that actually is a view of the world which actually is very consonant indeed with what we now know about modern cosmology. Augustine was quite innocent of these things, and so basically simply articulating what he finds in the texts. But again, you can see how this actually resonates remarkably well with a Big Bang cosmology and, of course, the subsequent idea of evolution. So in one sense, it's a very modern idea. But for Augustine, there are other things that need to be said. I have only time to mention one or two, and I will do those. I'll mention just two more themes in the time available. Number one, Augustine is very clear that since God created the world, something of God's beauty can be known through the created order. And therefore, Augustine encourages us to identify, to seek out, to value natural beauty, both as something that is good in itself, but as something also that's able to point beyond itself to God as its creator. And Augustine develops a quite complex theology of signs by which what we see in nature is to be valued in itself, but also has this capacity to point beyond itself to its creator. So Augustine is giving us a framework, if you like, for valuing nature, which can easily lead into an environmental ethic, but for Augustine is more to do with simply enjoying the world and allowing it to point beyond itself. And my final point, Dr. Solomon very rightly pointed out this idea of humanity being made in God's image. And for Augustine, that phrase needs interpretation. And Augustine argues that to be made in God's image is fundamentally about being rational, about having the capacity to be able to see the works of God in the work of God. In other words, to allow the created order to be a signpost to God himself. And therefore, one of the most fundamental themes that Augustine develops is that reflection on the created order is able to lead us back to God as its creator. Now, Augustine doesn't develop these ideas that we sometimes find in writers like William Paley, that in some way you can argue from nature to God. Rather, it's more subtle. He is saying that in some way, looking at the ordering, the beauty of nature, just creates within us this gut, deep down feeling that there has to be more than we see. And for Augustine, that points us to the road which leads to the discovery of God. So, an early Christian theologian reflecting on the texts that we're thinking about today, and one who I think points us off in some very interesting lines of thought that are well worth following through. Thank you.
So, our third and final speaker is Professor Yahya Michaud. He is a fellow at the Oxford Centre for Islamic Studies and a lecturer at the Faculty of Theology at the University of Oxford. He works particularly on medieval Islamic philosophy and theology, about which he's published extensively, mainly in French, but we are hoping for translations.
When the great mystic master Jalal ed-Din Rumi, who dies in Konya in 1273, was asked about the reason why God had created the world, he said, "God creating the world is like a woman on the roof platform of her house throwing a little pebble, a little stone in the street. It's for people to look at her, not to look at the stone. And that's what the world is worth in the eyes of many Muslims. And even in the Quran, you have this idea that whatsoever is on this earth, and more generally in the universe, will one day disappear and be annihilated, and only the face of God will remain. Which doesn't mean that God has created the heavens and the earth and whatever is in between them in vain or for play. And you can find in the Quran various narratives relating the way the world was created in 6 days. For example, in the verses 54 of chapter 7 of the Quran, God, who created the heavens and the earth in 6 days, and then he established himself on the throne. He draws the night as a veil over the day, each seeking the other in rapid succession. He created the sun, the moon, and the stars, all governed by laws under his command. Is it not his to create and to command? Blessed be God, the Lord of the universes. Many interpretations of this and similar verses are possible. Some philosophers, Muslim philosophers like Avicenna, had even no difficulty in speaking of an eternity of the world. And as Dr. Solomon was saying, the world then is just contingent, is eternal, but the relation with God is like the relation between a key and the hand that turns it in the door. The key cannot turn by itself, even if the movement is eternal. And so creationism is in itself not a problem, and many interpretations are still possible today, as there were in the classical period of Islam in relation to what was the knowledge, the scientific knowledge of the day. And Sufis themselves, reading those verses at some point, were led to think that, in fact, this distinction between the world and God was not that important, because there was nothing else but God. And if we exist, it is by him, because of him, and so we are essentially divine, and we should lose this illusion we have of being something different from him. So you can realize then that many, very diverse are the interpretations of creation in medieval classical thought. The page of the Mus'haf, of the copy of the Quran, which is exhibited next door, is very special about creation, because the pages that was chosen is in fact the first verses of Surat al-Alaq, the 96th chapter of the Quran. And it was chosen because it is considered by Muslims as the first verses that were revealed to the Prophet in 610 during one of his spiritual retreats in Mecca. And very strangely enough, you have the translation of those verses on the fourth page of the handout. Read, in the name of your Lord who created, he created man from a clinging mass or a clot. Read, and your Lord is the most generous, who taught by the pen, he taught men what he did not know. The narrative there is not cosmological. It's more embryological in some way. Which means that the first time God addresses humanity through Muhammad, it is man who is the focus. It is not the world as such. God is proclaimed the creator, but directly it is about man that creation is referred to. And this, I think, is not just by chance. It means that, in fact, creation does only make sense in some way because of man. And in those same verses, you have this idea that God not only creates mankind, but that he teaches men. Who read, and your Lord is the most generous, who taught by the pen, he taught men what he did not know. Which means that you can't just speak of creation without forgetting what will follow creation. What will follow creation is revelation. In some way, creation is only an opportunity for revelation. And Adam, the first man, is also the first prophet. Because there can't be any kind of humanity without prophethood. So revelation is in some way more important even than creation. And to look at God as being just the creator and forgetting that he is also the one who sends prophets is only having part of the picture. Which means that, in fact, there is a special relationship between God and humanity. And that the importance of man for God is beyond doubt. Man is not left alone in this world after having been created. Adam will be taught all the names. And so we realize that beyond creation, we have also to give importance to what is taught to us by God. Beyond creation, we have to look at ourselves as invited by God to follow the way of his prophets. And it is very strange that this first verse of the Quran revealed to Muhammad speaks of man already, not just about creation. And that the last word of the Quran, the last word of the last verse of chapter 114 of the Quran, will also be annas, men, people. Creation is about humanity. And so we have to take into consideration not just the creatures of God, but also his commandments, his laws. This little clot that is referred to, this clinging mass which is referred to in those verses, is spoken to by God. It can seem to be very humble. It's almost nothing. It's not important. But it is a nothing who will be invited by God to follow his laws and to walk on his path. It is a nothing that will be invited to religion and which will be invited to ethics. And ethics, then, what is taught to us by God, becomes, I think, the final focus of creation, and that is what is already alluded to from the beginning. Read, and your Lord is the most generous, who taught by the pen, who he taught men what he did not know. Thank you.
Well, thank you all very much for coming. Thank you particularly to our three speakers who agreed to come and distill a huge theme into 10 minutes each, and they have kept to their time. That's fantastic. We envisaged this originally as something that people could do in their lunch hour. They could come and listen to these three 10-minute talks, they could look at the manuscripts, and that could all be done in the lunch hour. So we haven't scheduled any discussion following this, but each of our speakers is going to be around for 10 or 15 minutes, and if you want to come up and talk to them, you're welcome to do so.